loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan were wiped out of their state's top offices in last month's election, but both legislatures called lame duck sessions to strip incoming Democratic governors of much of their power. The bills also reduce the time for early voting and throw poor people off of Medicaid. Next, special counsel Robert Mueller is asking a federal judge to sentence former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to probation, not to jail time, for lying to the FBI, citing Flynn's exceptional assistance in the Russia collusion investigation. Later this week, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort will be back in court, where Mueller will have to identify what Manafort has done to break his plea deal. And meanwhile, new information has emerged that Manafort met with Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno in 2017 about a complex deal that would involve Julian Assange's expulsion from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Then CIA Director Gina Haspel briefed a bipartisan group of senators on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi yesterday. Many came out of the briefing offering angry accounts of the information Haspel conveyed and said there was no doubt in their minds that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination. And then a Houthi delegation and the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, arrived in Stockholm last night in advance of peace talks with the Yemeni government. A Saudi delegation is expected to arrive today. Mediators from Kuwait, which hosted the last direct talks in 2016, are also in Sweden for the meetings, which should begin today. And finally, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro left for Moscow this morning, where he'll meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. No specific reason for the meeting was announced, but Putin said that he is acutely aware of the economic crisis in Venezuela, and the media are speculating that oil and gas will be on the agenda. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Wisconsin and Michigan. Republicans in those two states were wiped out of their state's top offices in last month's election, but both legislatures called lame duck sessions to strip incoming Democratic governors and attorneys general of much of their power. The bills also would reduce the time for early voting and throw poor people off of Medicaid. We're joined from Milwaukee by Matt Bruski. He's the Deputy Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Welcome to the show.
That's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We are glad that you're here because we need your expertise to explain some of these things. Now, I've read all the media this morning about what these two lame duck sessions or two lame duck legislatures have done. It sounds so crazy to me that I'm struggling to figure out how this is constitutional. So we're talking about shortening the amount of time that people can vote. We're talking about not allowing people to vote who aren't registered at least 2 weeks before an election. We're talking about throwing people off of Medicare and off of Medicaid, I should say. And then there was one that was just insane to me. And that is that the state, and this is in Michigan, this did not happen in Wisconsin. In the Michigan bill, the state of Michigan automatically makes itself a plaintiff in any case that's filed in a state court and has the same right of appeal as either of the other two parties in the case.
And then there's also, before Matt starts and helps us understand it, there's also what's happened where the governor in Wisconsin basically stripped of executive authority, and the same with the attorneys general.
Yes.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, look, it's very hard to explain, other than it's an attempt to basically overturn the will of the voters of Wisconsin, right? On November 6th, we overwhelmingly elected Democrats in statewide elections. And unfortunately, we have a legislature that has been gerrymandered. We had a very famous case that went to the Supreme Court. But yeah, we're heavily gerrymandered. So in spite of Democrats, more folks showing up and voting for Democrats in the state legislature, we still have the Republicans soundly in control of our legislature. And these Republicans have been very much about power. And that's what this is about. They're trying to overturn essentially what happened in statewide elections and trying to essentially take, obviously strip powers away from the governor, but also the attorney general. What you mentioned in Michigan is obviously even worse than what we have here in Wisconsin, but they're fundamentally the same thing, you know, trying to take power through whatever power they have left. And then you mentioned, I heard unconstitutional. Well, yes, it would seem so, but we have courts in this country and our state Supreme Court. That's an open question.
It seems like
it would be. I'll start with the early voting stuff. That would seem one that is certainly going to be sued. We were involved in the lawsuit with One Wisconsin Now and one of our organizers here, Anita Johnson, around early voting and things like that getting expanded. I think they're in real slippery area there. But all of this stuff's going to end up in court. It goes without saying.
It'll have to. Now, in 2011, when Governor Walker infamously tried to break the state's unions, people took to the streets. There was essentially an occupation of the state house, and there was a recall election. It failed, but it was close. Can you foresee direct action like this coming out of this new law?
It's obviously fluid here. The governor has not signed it yet, but everyone assumes he will. There's been at least a few high profile Republicans who are asking him to veto it, but everyone expects he'll pass it. There certainly was a lot of activity just the last few days. Not to the scale of tens of thousands like we saw with Act 10. Look, Act 10 had real impacts on this state. Our labor movement is not what it used to be in terms of its capacity, its organization. And we had one of the strongest labor movements going into 2011, particularly public sector labor movements, and that were able to mobilize and get people there. And a lot of those structures, you know, they're just, it's not the same, right? Those resources aren't there to, in 24, 48 hours, have buses organized around the state and other things in the kind of organization that leads to tens of thousands of folks. I think that's very real, and we need to be honest about that. It's one of what the right wing is about. This has always been about power and about reducing the power of people's organizations and left organizations and, you know, the organizations that help make up certainly the Democratic Party in our state. So that's a part of it, but let's not forget there were thousands of people in Madison the last few nights protesting, hundreds of people testifying. By the way, nobody testifying in support of their legislation, which is amazing when you think about it. No regular person, right, other than the people that they bring to testify, and hundreds of people in opposition. I mean, the thought that Democrats would ever move something bold and visionary that would have no support from anyone, it just wouldn't happen. It just shows we're dealing with a party that's all about power here right now.
You know, I have to ask, too, these Democratic victories last month were so large. The Republicans just were wiped out. I think I used that term in the intro. But the legislature remains Republican. Why is that? Is that a result of gerrymandering?
Yes, it's clearly a result of gerrymandering. I think that there's no doubt about that. It's also a little bit, this is part of it, right? We're increasingly polarized society where people are geographically placing themselves into concentrations of people who are more like them. And I think this election, we saw increased polarization in our state. Our Milwaukee suburbs have been traditionally extraordinarily conservative. The city of Wauwatosa, when I grew up in Wauwatosa, it was a ruby red Republican town. Overwhelmingly Democratic this cycle. The only assembly seat that Democrats were able to pick up was in the Wauwatosa suburbs. And these are seats that used to be solidly held by Republicans. So we're seeing concentrations of Democratic voters in cities and increasingly now the suburbs and the rural areas largely dominated by Republican. And let's be honest, increasingly more seemingly in the grips of, I'll call it white nationalism and a lot of what Trump is pitching. So, but gerrymandering is huge, huge. And it was effectively done by the Republicans. So yes, we had well over 50% show up voting for Democratic state legislative candidates, but they still hold 60 plus seats. Democrats, I think, have 30, 36. So we're talking massive disparities. So
yeah, that's huge.
Virtually no pathway to stopping this stuff in the assembly. The Senate was a 4-vote majority. One senator bolted on one of the bills. So, but they, you know, these things pass with gerrymandered legislature.
Yeah, it's like there's no way to stop something like that. If the fix is in, the only thing you can do is take to the courts. I was reading an article this morning in Milwaukee's newspaper in which the reporter quoted a law professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he said that that's really the only alternative is to go to the courts. But he said something very interesting. He said, if this were a federal issue and we could go to the federal courts, it's obviously unconstitutional and would be overturned. But the state courts are different because the state constitutions are different, and the Republicans just might get away with this.
Yes, and we have a Supreme Court that is held by conservatives right now. I do expect this will become a major issue in our Supreme Court election next spring. We have an April Supreme Court election. Shirley Abrahamson, who was one of our former Chief Justice and a great progressive justice, is stepping down. But progressives are defending a progressive seat. But yeah, definitely, we have a Supreme Court that has become very much beholden of special interests, large amounts of money in these elections, and has basically legalized bribery in the state of Wisconsin in terms of what you can do coordinating between parties and candidates. Nobody necessarily thinks that our courts are going to necessarily save us here.
Jeez. In our last minute and a half, tell us what the next steps are.
I just want to say that it's been impressive. While there maybe were tens of thousands of people protesting, there were hundreds and thousands of people very strategically trying to do the lobbying, talk to people. There were thousands of people in Madison, and they are paying a public price for this. I really do think, you know, this is not going over well, and there has been polling on our side that shows independents overwhelmingly oppose what they're doing. We have to stay focused on power, and that means we have to win some of these gerrymandered seats, and there are more seats that we can win next cycle, but we just need to stay focused on constantly building power. But also, I mean, we got to be out in the streets. We got to be agitating where appropriate and where, you know, to try to keep the pressure on them. So I think there's some old-fashioned power building through elections, but also we got to organize. We got to keep organizing workers. There's still tens of thousands of voters who don't show up, and we need to continue to engage these folks both in cities and rurally and educating folks about what's happening. So there are people that are moving, that are changing, or that are opening their minds to what's going on. It's just, that's hard organizing.
Well, we'll leave it there. That was the voice of Matt Bruschi, who joined us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Matt is the Deputy Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller is asking a federal judge to sentence former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to probation, not jail time, for lying to the FBI, citing Flynn's exceptional assistance, that's what he called it, in the Russia collusion investigation. Later this week, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort will be back in court, where Mueller will have to identify what Manafort has done to break his plea deal. And meanwhile, new information has emerged that Manafort met with Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno in 2017 about a complex deal that would involve Julian Assange's expulsion from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, let's start with Mike Flynn. Flynn likely will not see jail time. The recommendation in the federal code was 0 to 6 months anyway. But Mueller is calling his assistance exceptional. Now, there was one thing I have to say as an aside. In the Greek press this morning, the banner headlines were about how details have come out about Flynn's efforts to kidnap or assist in the kidnapping of Fethullah Gulen, the Turkish opposition leader who lives outside of Pittsburgh. That really wasn't the big situation here. Vox has a fantastic piece talking about Flynn and what kind of assistance Flynn provided, but there aren't any real details and nobody ever mentions the word Russia. So what do you think? What is it that Flynn could have given Mueller that's so great that it leads to no jail time?
I really have no idea. I think probably the answer is that he had nothing particularly important on Flynn himself. At least he didn't want to go. The mention of the Gulen thing is very interesting, because Flynn was a very big promoter of Turkish interests. He was paid a lot of money for that. So if you want something about interfering in American elections or election process, you'd go there. But Mueller didn't want to go there. What this lying to the what Flynn has been convicted of or pled guilty to is some lying about speaking to the Russian ambassador. Now, he spoke to the Russian ambassador about trying to get Russia to go to work on behalf of Israel in terms of the UN vote that was coming up. And they also then talked about that Russia wouldn't go overboard in its reaction to American sanctions. But there was nothing wrong with this conversation. And I don't know why Flynn said he didn't talk to the Russian ambassador to the FBI, but the fact that he didn't say that meant he lied to the FBI. Therefore, that's a felony. Therefore, this is what he's being convicted of. So I don't know that he has anything else against Flynn to go after him for. So, you know, the idea that now they're putting out this notion that Flynn's a great cooperator, an extraordinary cooperator, as you say, but what is he cooperating about? I don't know.
The sentencing memo is absolutely fascinating. Most of it actually is redacted. I want to read just a couple of little clips here. It says, the defendant has assisted with several ongoing investigations. The word several meaning three, right? One, a criminal investigation, and the rest is redacted. Two,
big blocks of black.
Big blocks of black. That's right. The special counsel's office investigation concerning any links or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald J. Trump. Everybody in the world knew that. And the third is every word of it's blacked out. It's completely blacked out. But Vox is saying that here are the takeaways. There's a criminal investigation. We don't know what it is. There's the Russia investigation. He was supposedly helpful somehow. There's a third investigation that's apparently so sensitive that nobody is even allowed to know what the investigation is of. But it goes on to say something that's very interesting. Mueller says Flynn helped his investigation, and here's the quote, on a range of issues, including interactions between individuals in the presidential transition team and Russia. Okay, if you've just won the presidency, you're preparing and your staff is preparing to create a foreign policy, doesn't it stand to reason that you're going to meet with representatives of what is arguably the second most powerful nation in the world?
Every new transition team, I want people to hear this, every new transition team after the November elections and before the person takes office, they meet with other foreign officials, including diplomats in Washington, D.C. The fact that Michael Flynn talked twice to Kislyak, who was the Russian ambassador, he talked to him on December 22nd, where Flynn was urging the Russians not to support a resolution or bring a resolution to the floor at the United Nations that would condemn Israel for building illegal settlements, a resolution that Obama had said the U.S. would abstain on, meaning it would pass. Flynn had talked to Jared Kushner. He urgently asked the Russians, please, please don't go forward with this resolution, to which the Russians the next day called Flynn back and said, no, we're going forward. And then the next conversation was about a week later, December 29th, where Flynn calls Kislyak back. And this is the day after Obama announced new sanctions on Russia and expulsion of Russian diplomats.
Yes.
What Flynn was saying to Kislyak was, don't do anything that's out of proportion. He didn't say don't retaliate. He said, don't do anything that's extra. That's his recommendation. Those are the two things that he lied about to the FBI in January 25th or 24th after he became National Security Advisor, when the FBI obviously knew verbatim exactly what he said because they had the NSA intercepts.
And he apparently knew that thing. That's what's strange about it.
Maybe Flynn should have been indicted for being dumb.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, like, why lie about something that's not illegal? Maybe that's just what Flynn does. Maybe he just always lies. Maybe that's his thing.
And that was really the jumpstart of this whole Russiagate thing. And appointing a special counsel because Flynn lied about talking to Kislyak. There's nothing there. I mean, there was no reason to appoint a special counsel.
No, you're exactly right. And later in this sentencing memo, they make a big deal out of the fact that once he told the lie, Pence and Sean Spicer repeated it. Okay, that's fine. But who cares? There was no damage to anything. It's like a victimless crime.
Wouldn't collusion require it to be collusion during the presidential campaign?
Exactly.
Not after the election.
That's what collusion is.
Yeah, didn't affect the election. Whatever he did then didn't affect the election.
No, exactly. And I think that Americans want to know if we have an illegitimate president in the White House. If there was collusion before the election, then arguably maybe we do. But even the FBI is not alleging that. It's like they're flailing around looking for some way to justify this the direction of this investigation.
Let's go on to Manafort. We have 2 minutes left. Just 2 minutes. Manafort's going to be in court on Friday. Mueller is going to have to say why Mueller is no longer cooperating, has rescinded the plea deal for Manafort. At the same time, different stories came out about Manafort and Assange. One story in The Guardian saying that he secretly met with Assange, meaning or suggesting that Manafort was somehow linked with WikiLeaks and Russia, blah, 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 in terms of the revelations of the hack of DNC emails. But now there's this other story where Manafort's actually trying to work out the expulsion of Assange. Go ahead.
Yeah, but this is very important. First of all, this was known about. The Ecuadorian government put out a memo at the time saying that there was a meeting with Manafort. So this is not a secret, again. Secondly, the Times article on this is really very nasty, and it's like the Guardian article, where they had to change everything to, oh, Manafort met with this. Oh, well, maybe he met with it. He could have. If he had, you know, they changed the language. The Times actually changed the headline of this article. The original headline was Manafort tried to broker deal with Ecuador to hand Assange over to the U.S., and they changed it to Manafort discussed deal with Ecuador to hand Assange over to the U.S. Manafort was down there as, again, the guy who wanted to make some money out of his relationships with the new president. He went down as a representative of China to make a deal for the Chinese to invest in Ecuadorian electric utility. And the Ecuadorians brought up Assange in the conversation.
That is important because you would never gather that from the headline.
Never gather that from the headline. That's why they had to change the headline. Manafort wasn't trying to broker anything. Manafort went down there to discuss. He was trying to broker a deal between China and Ecuador for a big investment in the electric company. And the Ecuadorians brought up Assange. Mm-hmm. And they said, we want to get rid of Assange. Can you help us with that? And he was like, well, I don't know. Maybe I can talk to. But, you know, he wasn't down there for that. No mention was made of Russia. In the language of the article, it says there's no evidence that Mr. Manafort was working with or even briefing President Trump or other administration officials on the discussion with the Ecuadorians about Mr. Assange, nor is there any evidence that the brief involvement in the talks was motivated by concerns about the role that Mr. Assange and WikiLeaks played in facilitating the Russian effort to help Mr. Trump in the 2016 presidential election. Again, making the presumption that WikiLeaks was facilitating the Russian effort. It's really very nasty. It's a very nasty article. And it's, again, this whole... it's a tsunami of headlines that are made to give the impression that there's some close relationship between Manafort and Assange and WikiLeaks, and they were working together with the Russians, even though there's no evidence of that. You get down to the fifth and sixth paragraph, you find there's no evidence of that.
Yeah. Jim Kavanaugh is right, John. The audience, all of us have to be aware. What we're getting now are headlines. They're misleading headlines. You have to read down to the fifth or sixth paragraph. You have to parse it. It's very hard for most people to keep track of this, but it's really all about the headlines. It's not about the facts.
It is, and everybody has to be an analyst in order to figure out what's actually happening in the news. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
CIA Director Gina Haspel briefed a bipartisan group of senators on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi yesterday. Many came out of the briefing offering angry accounts of the information Haspel conveyed and said there was no doubt in their minds that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Welcome back, Ali.
Thank you for having me.
We're very happy to have you. You can offer us a unique insight here. We've got a political situation now where members of the president's own party are adamant that something has to be done. I've mentioned a couple of times on this show that in the past, and there is a precedent for this, in the past, the CIA director would go discreetly to the king and say the crown prince has to go. I doubt highly that this president would do such a thing. So how does this play out? How does it end? Are there going to be sanctions on Saudi Arabia? Is Mohammed bin Salman going to have to depart? How does it play out?
The reason that Gina Haspel did not go to Riyadh to tell the king his son has to go because the king does not control the airspace. It's Mohammed bin Salman who does. And he is the gatekeeper to his father. So no one can go see the king unless MBS approves it. So, and he would not do that. She has to go through MBS before going seeing the king. So that throws that thing away. I don't think it is the U.S. policy for, when I say the U.S., I'm talking about the state, not only Mr. Trump, to replace Mohammed bin Salman. I think the U.S. policy is to maintain Mohammed bin Salman as a weakened leader. It's more advantageous for U.S. interest, in their view, because having a weaker leader allows the U.S. to project its power and influence at a greater level than if he was a strong and somewhat of a legitimate person in his government. So I think they are weary of him being the only person. They cannot play anybody else against him. So, and that is, I think, one of the reasons that made the U.S. reaction to the murder greater, because now there's only one person to go to. There's only one address in Riyadh, and that is MBS.
You know, let's talk about some of this evidence that's leaked out of the CIA or leaked out of this briefing. Apparently, there were 11 phone calls in the hours before, during, and after Khashoggi's murder between the leader of the team that was sent to Turkey and the crown prince himself. Now, for someone in the intelligence community to leak information that is so highly classified as a telephone intercept, to burn that source, has to be a political point that's being made. Besides that, it seems to me that the administration or somebody in the administration wanted everybody to know that there was this direct correlation. Now, the CIA, just because this is the CIA's writing style, the CIA will never come out and say, Mohammed bin Salman did it. What they would say is, our evidence points to the likelihood that Mohammed bin Salman did it. That was the little wiggle room that the president used last week. But if these leaks are to be believed, the CIA has concluded that Mohammed bin Salman did it.
Yes, I think that was pretty obvious early on from the way that government, Saudi regime operates, is you cannot do these things without having the approval of the top power. You cannot create and arrange for all of these planes and access to the consulate and so on without and having these people from different government departments, without having the knowledge of the crown prince, who is very involved in the operations of the daily operations of the government. So you could not put this team together without his knowledge. And probably there are more people involved, but we don't know at the moment. But I think in the future we will see other people are involved, such as people in the embassy, such as the Minister of Foreign Affairs, ambassador here who just returned this morning at 7 a.m. to attend the Bush funeral. So I think there is an American desire to keep this at a certain level, to contain it within, I would say, a balanced level, to allow the U.S. to project its power and to create a greater advantage vis-a-vis the relationship with the Saudi government.
Yeah, let's go back to the beginning of Mohammed bin Salman's tenure, too. He launched what was essentially a coup. There was a crown prince. It was Mohammed bin Nayef, his cousin. Mohammed bin Nayef was certainly the favorite of the U.S. government. He was even given the CIA's highest honor, which in my career, I never saw anybody get, but they gave it to Mohammed bin Nayef. Mohammed bin Nayef was deposed, and within hours, he was arrested and sent to the Ritz-Carlton, I think? Dozens of cousins were sent to the Ritz-Carlton under house arrest. A couple died mysteriously, and the next thing you know, Mohammed bin Salman is the crown prince. Is there any way, Ali, to undo that? Is there any way for a faction of the family to reimpose Mohammed bin Nayef in that position? Or is Mohammed bin Salman too strong?
It's too strong and without external interference, I don't think there is a possibility of removing Mohammed bin Salman. He is the man to beat. He controls all facets of power, and his viable competition are unable even to step foot outside the door of their own homes. So they're under lock and key, and he does have the support, I think, of the bureaucracy or part of it, and especially the security, the internal security and the military. So far, we have seen no defections, no weakening of that grip. The U.S. I believe the U.S. lost a lot of its assets. I think that's for another show, but the CIA, when Mohammed bin Salman came, he cleaned house, so he would be the only source of information inside the palace, and he blocked everybody else. So the U.S., including the CIA, does not have enough resources or eyeballs inside the walls of the Saudi palace. The most of their assets, like Mohammed bin Nayef, who is a terrible person, by the way, he has a lot of blood on his hand, and he supported terrorism. So I know some people in the U.S. are saying, "Oh, replace another one prince with another prince," which is, to be honestly, very offensive, because they take away the population and their desire or their aspirations away. This is not a country occupied by monkeys. There are people, and this is not the only choice. We are being given a false choice between one prince and another. The right choice, the American choice, I would say, is for the people to make that decision. And just like the Americans did in 1776, when they decided that they don't want a king and they didn't want another king or another prince, they wanted their own government. And I think that's the choice that I'm making clear, that anyone, any American, no matter how high, is suggesting that one prince replace another is bigoted and offending the dignity of our people.
Those are strong, important words, John, from our guest, Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs here in Washington, D.C. Ali, just a quick question. If Mohammed bin Salman, if the Americans don't mind a weakened Mohammed bin Salman is remaining in power, because then the U.S. exercises even more leverage over Saudi Arabia now that his wings have been clipped somewhat. So, from a point of view of realpolitik, they're good with it. I'm just wondering if Mohammed bin Salman at the same time has to round up the people who were taking direction from him, some 17 of them or more, arrest them, put several of them on trial, hang a few of them or execute a few of them. It would suggest to other people who are also doing his dirty work, you know, that he doesn't have their back. I just wonder whether it makes him more vulnerable or not. We've talked about that, John Kiriakou and I, but we don't have any sort of insider understanding of how things work in Saudi Arabia. What's your take on that?
You must realize that for these executions to take place, if we believe this is the reality, it will take maybe 20 years for them to come to fruition. Because the Saudi system depends on, after trial, if these persons were sentenced to death, they will have to wait for all the children of the deceased or the victim to become adults to make a decision if they want to basically seek justice on the killer of their father. And we have information that Mr. Khashoggi is expecting a child early in 2019. So you have to count 20 years from there. By that time, everything would have disappeared, and the government can force a settlement, what they call a blood settlement, where killers would pay blood money and everything would be forgiven and they would be released. They are not in prison, as far as I know, those supposed killers, and I don't think they will end up in prison anytime soon. So I think it's just they're buying their time, and the king can interfere anytime and pardon them, just like what you have here in terms of investigating Mr. Trump. He can pardon these people anytime.
We just did a segment about George H.W. Bush and all the people convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors who were pardoned by George H.W. Bush, including the Secretary of Defense. Very, very interesting and illuminating discussion, John, because Ali brings us insights and analysis that we don't get from the mainstream media.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. These conversations are not taking place in the mainstream media. And I wish we had more time, because I'd like to ask Ali about the Al Saud Family Council. We can do that next time. But this is an ongoing problem, and the stakes are very, very high. So we'll leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Houthi delegation and the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, arrived in Stockholm last night in advance of peace talks with the Yemeni government. A Saudi delegation is expected to arrive today. Mediators from Kuwait, which hosted the last direct talks in 2016, are also in Sweden for the meetings, which should begin today. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, thanks for joining us. I want to start off by asking you about the chances of a breakthrough this time around. Peace talks were held between the Houthis and the Yemeni government in 2016, hosted by the Kuwaitis. Nothing came of those meetings. We know that there's a prisoner swap underway where 1,500 Houthis are being traded for 1,200 government troops. Is this different this time? Do you think that there's a chance that there could be a breakthrough?
I hope I'm wrong, but I'm very doubtful. I don't think that the Saudis have the incentive yet to stop this war. It's a war that they've lost, even though they've been making ordinary people in Yemen suffer. The real government in Yemen is the Houthi-led government because they hold the capital, and the overwhelming majority of the people of Yemen live in territories held by the Houthis or Ansar Allah and their allies. But the Saudis are unwilling to accept the reality on the ground, and Trump does not seem to have any interest in ending this, what many people in Iran consider to be a holocaust. In Kuwait, there was a real opportunity to end the war, and from what I've heard, they were close to a deal. But then suddenly the Saudis rejected the negotiations and left the table. I think now the Saudis are going to be under some pressure because of what's going on in the United States, but I don't think that there will be any substantial change, but let's hope I'm wrong.
You know, this is a very important point, too. Donald Trump has essentially abdicated any leadership in this. He seems so far unwilling to pressure the Saudis to do anything about ending the war. And now we've got this situation on Capitol Hill from yesterday, Mohammed, where Gina Haspel, the CIA director, went to Capitol Hill and briefed a bipartisan group of senators from the Foreign Relations Committee, from the Armed Services Committee, and from the Intelligence Committee. And they came out of this briefing unanimous in their conclusion that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination, the execution of Jamal Khashoggi. Do you think that what's happening in Washington now with the Khashoggi killing might have any impact on the Saudi decision to stay in Yemen? Or do you think that the Saudis could be preoccupied enough with Khashoggi and with improving relations with Washington that maybe they would conclude it's time to pull out?
I don't think that they are going to pull out until they see the White House push them in that direction. And there's no reason to believe that that's going to happen. Pompeo, just a couple of days ago, gave his full support for the Saudi aggression in the country and Saudi actions there. So I'm not optimistic at all. What I do think, though, is that the opposition to Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, in the United States is growing, and that is going to weaken Saudi Arabia. There will probably be some sanctions, but I don't think it's going to have an impact on the war. But I do think it's going to hurt MBS more than before. And I think that the longer MBS stays in power, the weaker Saudi Arabia becomes. If Trump was going to be smart, he would have him removed, and then the new crown prince would be able to support U.S. policies across the board without any problem. But I think Trump can't do this because it'll be seen as some sort of humiliation when he's dealing with his antagonists in Washington. So I think that, I hope I'm wrong, but I think that the war will continue. And MBS being so weak, probably he thinks that if he calls it quits, this will be another defeat for him and further weaken his position.
You know, if you ask the handful of Americans who have ever heard of Yemen what they know, I think many of them will say, oh, well, The Saudis are in Yemen because of the Iranians. What exactly is the Iranian role in Yemen? Or maybe more appropriately, is there an Iranian role in Yemen?
I don't think that there ever was a really big role at all. I mean, I'm quite confident of that from the very beginning. And if there is a role, it began after the Saudi aggression because the people of Yemen had no other support. But even if Iran is supporting Yemen, and I'm sure it is to a limited degree, it is very limited simply because of the siege. The United States and the Saudis have imposed an embargo. They won't allow even food or medicine to get into the country. So I'm sure that any Iranian support is very limited. But if anyone just looks at the map, they'll see that the Iranians really have no way of being able to easily support the people of Yemen. Of course, I think if the Iranians could help them, they would help them. And they are helping them to a degree, in my opinion, from my understanding. But it's nothing compared to the amount of money the Saudis are spending on this catastrophic war and the siege that the Americans and the Saudis and others are imposing on ordinary people and imposing starvation and death and destruction in order to bring the country to its knees. But the longer this takes, this war, I think the worse it's going to be for Saudi Arabia, in the sense that the people of Yemen see that the Saudis are in trouble. They've seen the global reaction to what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, and they've seen how everyone has turned against MBS. And therefore, the longer the Saudis continue this war, I think the more demanding Ansar Allah, the Houthis, and their allies will be at the negotiating table. So the smart thing would be for the Americans and the Saudis to bring this to an end, but I don't think the two governments are very smart.
I think it would be a very, very good idea for everybody listening to this podcast, take a moment, or this radio show, take a moment afterwards and go look at a map. I mean, look for a map of Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Iran, because it says so much. I mean, the geography says so much. And again, this is very distant for most Americans, but Iran is not close to Yemen, not at all. I mean, Yemen shares a long northern border with Saudi Arabia. Its northeastern border is with Oman, and the west is the Red Sea. The Gulf of Aden is on the south. It's all the way across the Persian or Arabian Gulf, however you want to describe that gulf, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I mean, Iran is far, far away.
It is. It's far away. And besides that, continue looking at that map. It's got a long coast in the south, but that area is not hospitable to the Houthis or to Iranians were they to land on the shore. And so if the Iranians were going to do something like provide weapons, let's say, or provide explosives or vehicles or whatever, they would have to go through the Bab al-Mandeb and then come up the Red Sea coast. It's just not possible. You just can't do it.
And the thing is, Mohammed, with that said, if I turned on a TV station today, it could be Fox, meaning a conservative right-wing statement station, or MSNBC, liberal, so-called, whatever, liberal doesn't mean anything anymore. But all of them would make the argument that that this is simply a proxy war. I mean, that really truly dominates the U.S. narrative. And mainly, we're told to fear and hate Iranians. So the big problem in Yemen is Iran. I mean, that is the dominant narrative. Both sides, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. It's not just Trump.
Well, the term proxy is used in order to create some sort of or make it to appear like there's some sort of moral equivalence. And where in reality, it's obviously not the case. Just like in Gaza, the Israeli regime has imposed a blockade for a very long time now. And in order to justify that blockade, they call Hamas or the resistance organizations in Gaza Iranian proxies, whereas these are people who are fighting for their land. Most people in Gaza actually are exiles from Palestine proper. They are not originally from Gaza. Or, for example, they call Hezbollah a proxy, whereas Hezbollah was a national resistance organization that expelled Israel from southern Lebanon. But the problem is that while the term proxy is completely inaccurate and they're trying to hide this injustice and this aggression through making the indigenous population, through erasing the resistance and the legitimacy of the resistance of the indigenous population. What it also does is it makes them miscalculate, because they start believing their own propaganda about proxies. And then they think, well, if it's a proxy, then they can defeat it. But they can't defeat it, because these are real people who have real interests, who want their independence and dignity. And even through starvation, you cannot make them kneel. And that's why they constantly fail in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, Iraq, in Syria. And that is what I think is bringing down the whole order that the United States established in this region over the last few decades.
That was the same fundamental miscalculation that the U.S. used during the Cold War.
Absolutely.
Where the U.S. thought, hey, Vietnam, the North Vietnamese are just proxies of Russia or China, or the same with the Koreans. So we can defeat them, as Muhammad said, because they're just proxies. But bottom line is that they're people who are in their own homes. They're not going anywhere. They have no desire to go anywhere. And so they're going to fight and fight and resist and resist. And ultimately, the U.S. or whatever power, no matter what its air power or technological superiority, they lose.
It's true. We're going to have to leave it on that note. We were joined from Tehran by Mohammad Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro left for Moscow this morning, where he'll meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. No specific reason for the meeting was announced, but Putin said that he is acutely aware of the economic crisis in Venezuela, and the media are speculating that oil and gas will be on the agenda. We're joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul, welcome back. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
Thanks for joining us. What are you hearing in Venezuela about this this visit? It seems like it was kind of short notice. Do you know anything about the agenda?
We can suspect that, obviously, as you mentioned, mining, gas, energy are going to be top on the list. But I think another very important aspect which they're going to be talking about will be financial aid to Venezuela, or facilitating credit more particularly. President Maduro has been trying in the last couple of months to strengthen allies, strengthen relationships with strategic allies, which obviously includes Russia, but also includes Iran, includes China, India, and Turkey, with the objective of bypassing US-led financial sanctions against the country and assuring a credit flow which allows him to bring the country out of the current economic recession which we're living through.
Paul Dobson, let's just talk about the state of the Venezuelan economy. As you look back, say, over the past 2 years, it's gone through a great, great deal of hardships. The Maduro government has said over and over again that there's an economic war being waged against the government and its policies and its attempt to create a new system based on social justice and equality. Is it getting worse? Has it stabilized? And what and how does the economic war that Maduro describes, how does it actually function? How does it work?
Well, when President Maduro talks about the economic war, what he's essentially referring to is a whole range of measures in the economic field which hinder or look to prohibit the economic development of the country. Now, when Maduro talks about these measures, he's talking about a conscientious effort by these economic factors to undermine the Venezuelan economy. Other analysts have doubted whether this phenomena is conscientious or not. But what we're essentially talking about here is efforts to hoard important goods. We're talking about extraction, smuggling, so taking subsidized goods from Venezuela and exporting them, taking them across their borders to Colombia, to Brazil, and selling them for extortionate profits. And obviously, very importantly, is the Pentagon's and the White House's financial sanctions against Caracas, which are also a very clear example of an effort to undermine the Venezuelan economy.
I want to ask, too, Paul, if you can comment at all on the Venezuelan government's use of Bitcoin or its own cryptocurrency in order to get around the use of the dollar and to try to rein in inflation. Is that working at all? And is there any way that the Russians can help Venezuela?
We've not seen much impact of this on the ground, at least here in Venezuela, so far. Now, I remember that most of these transactions will be done at a very high level and will have a relatively small impact on the day-to-day life of Venezuelans beyond the satisfying or the supplying of basic goods into the shelves of the shops. What it is important to point out is that the Venezuelan government are looking for new ways or interesting ways to bypass these sanctions, which include paying for things in kind, paying for international trade deals with oil or paying for them with cryptocurrencies and other measures. One example of this, for example, is the supply of the food products which are used in the government's food program called the CLAP food program, which is a subsidized food box given out to families, is mostly made up of stable goods which have come from Turkey or Mexico or other strategic partners which Venezuela has. They're not generally produced locally. So the international trade deals to pay for these goods are increasingly being done in non-dollar currencies or in kind.
Yeah, Paul Dobson is our guest. Paul is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're speaking to Paul from Venezuela about the visit of Nicolas Maduro, the president of Argentina, to Russia to meet with Vladimir Putin. Paul, Venezuela needs allies, clearly. A lot of its allies in Latin America have vanished because of the political shift to the right. It's all over. It's Ecuador, it's Brazil, Argentina, Honduras. At the same time, we have a new president in Mexico, a progressive government in Mexico. And Mexico is a big country, 14th largest economy in the world, for a long time, for many decades, considered the leader in Latin America of Latin American independence and sovereignty. What does that portend for Venezuela? Is this a big event for Venezuela, the fact that there's a progressive government in Mexico?
Definitely. There's been a massive wave of new hope here in the grassroots movements in Venezuela with the election of a commonly described AMLO president. It's very important that President Maduro went to the opening inauguration ceremony of López Obrador. And as I explained previously, there are already existing important trade deals between Mexico and Venezuela, which I think will only be strengthened with this new shift in Mexican politics. People here on the left in Venezuela are talking about a resurge in regional integrational policies and a series of whole other issues. And the new hope, which basically they feel by this turning of the tide and the re-election of a left-wing president after so many regional defeats, as you pointed out.
Paul Dobson is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM. You can hear us at the same time at SputnikNews.com. You can subscribe to this show as a podcast at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio. You can listen to us at Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Paul Dobson, very important. I'm glad we're having this discussion about the international alliances or assistance that might be coming the way of Venezuela to counter the economic war that the United States and Venezuelan elites are working against the Maduro government and in tandem with each other. Let's talk in our last 2 minutes about Venezuela's relationship with China. The G20 was just in Latin America, was in Argentina. I noticed that Xi Jinping, on his way out of the G20, was stopping in Panama, a traditional U.S. ally. But China, of course, is putting a premium on its relations with other countries, developing countries, emerging countries in Africa, also Latin America. What about Venezuela and China?
Well, Venezuela and China have got massively extensive political and economic relations already, which seem to get stronger every year. China are only too glad to fill the hole left by U.S. and European investors in Latin America, and provided some vital assistance to Venezuela in the last few years. The Chinese have brought in a lot of infrastructure into Venezuela, a lot of technical know-how, and, as I mentioned previously, a very extensive credit line, which have basically enabled the Venezuelan government to keep the economy breathing, even if struggling, but definitely breathing in the last few years. Some analysts have claimed that if it wasn't for the Chinese help, the Venezuelan economy would have collapsed more so than it has done and would have had to default on a lot of its international debts. So the relationship with China is very, very important for the Venezuelan government. And it's important also to point out that most of these trade deals are not the traditional international trade deals that, that you'd used to be seeing. They involve what's called here the transfer of technology, which is basically the training up of Venezuelans to take over the roles, the technical roles being carried out by the Chinese technicians. And one good example of this is the space program. The first satellite with Venezuela put into space was mostly done with Chinese know-how. The second one, a little bit less. And the recent one, which is about to go up in the next few months, is mostly done with Venezuelan technicians, obviously with a little bit of help from the Chinese still. But there's a massive, there's a very clear transfer of technology training up the Venezuelans to bring about their own economic development.
Paul Dobson, in our last minute, what comes next in terms of the political struggle inside of Venezuela? What's the status of the opposition to Maduro, and what happens with the next election cycle?
Well, the next electoral cycle is in a few days. This Sunday, we have our fifth election in 18 months, which is not bad for a country which Washington describes as a dictatorship, I think. We have local council elections being held this Sunday, where Venezuelans will elect councillors in the 335 municipalities of the country. We have a very strong list of candidates from the government. We have a very strong list of candidates from other left-wing parties, but this in this instance, challenging government candidates. And we have a very strong list of candidates from right-wing parties and opposition parties who are participating in most of the municipalities across the country. Some right-wing parties have decided to boycott this election, as they did in the last presidential election, but the vast majority of them numerically are participating and undoubtedly will win a very significant amount of councillors across Venezuela. So that's this Sunday. So all of your listeners should keep your eyes on Venezuela analysis, and we'll be covering this live this Sunday.
John Curiaco, it is a very, very unusual dictatorship that has all of these elections, the fifth in 18 months. Just really stunning.
And it's a place where the opposition can just arbitrarily decide to boycott those elections.
Yeah. We are going to come back on Monday to follow the elections. Paul, hopefully you would be able to join us. We'd love to have you come back and do an assessment on Loud and Clear.
It'd be my pleasure.
That was the voice of Paul Dobson, who joined us from Mérida, Venezuela. Paul's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.